The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. As usual, I will begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the November 8, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Haunting of Aji Hotak, by Jamil John Kochai. You don't know why exactly you've been assigned to this particular family in this particular home in West Sacramento, California. It's not your job to wonder why. Nonetheless, after a few days, you begin to speculate that the suspect at the heart of your assignment is the father, codenamed Haji, even though you have no reason to believe that he has ever actually completed the Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. In fact, Haji hardly leaves home at all. He spends hours at a time wandering around his house or his yard, searching for things to repair. Rotted planks of wood, missing shingles, burned out bulbs, broken mowers, shattered windows, unhinged doors, until his old injuries act up, and he is forced to lie down wherever he is working. And if he happens to be in the attic or the basement, or in some other secluded area of the house, away from his wife and his mother and his four children, sometimes he will allow himself to quietly mutter verses from the Quran, invocations to Allah, until his ache seems to ebb and he returns to work. When Haji has exhausted himself, he often retires to the living room, where he watches murder mysteries or foreign coverage of conflicts in Islamic countries. If his wife, codenamed Habibi, is in the kitchen, and if she isn't already chatting with one of her many friends, most of whom, you know, Haji despises, he will request a cup of tea and ask about his mother's health, which is never very good. But Haji's wife doesn't tell him this because his mother, codenamed Bibi, is sitting just a few feet away, and though she doesn't acknowledge her son's presence, Bibi is always listening. From early dawn, when she wakes to pray, until late at night, before she falls into a fitful sleep, Bibi nests in a corner of the living room, on the farthest edge of the second couch, and listens to the television at an incredibly low volume, listens to her son and his wife in the kitchen, to her grandchildren on their phones, to the Quran on an old radio that she smuggled out of Afghanistan 40 years ago, to the flushing of the toilets in the house, to the wind in the trees that her son planted near her window, to the gentle burbling of her oxygen tank, and to the constant thrumming of the house. And she reports back all that she hears to her only living brother in Afghanistan. Thanks to Bibi's keen ear for even the most minute details, her calls are thorough and uncompromising. She knows when her grandchildren are constipated. She knows when her son and his wife are secretly fighting. She knows who is peeing too loudly or cheating on exams or missing prayers. Through Bibi's many reports to her brother, you begin to gather snippets of Haji's history, his former life as a mujahideen in Afghanistan, his trek from Logar to Peshawar to Karachi to California, his wedding, the births of each of his children, the children's gradual loss of Pashto, their gradual increase in insolence, the trucking accident that destroyed the nerves in Haji's neck and shoulder, the court cases that led to nothing, the betrayal he felt when his second eldest son, codenamed Carl, decided to become a Marxist while studying at Berkeley, his depression, his total disillusionment with the American justice system, his anger, his rage, his softly bubbling fury. In another life, you think, Bibi might have been a spy. Haji's eldest son, Mo, gets home from his job at Safar's butcher shop in the evening. He wears a blood-splattered smock, an Arabic thobe, and a heavy beard. Every night, Mo's mother scolds him for not having washed his smock, which smells like a massacre, and every night Haji defends his son, who smells, he says, like a man. Mo begs his mother's forgiveness with a laugh and sits beside his father. In English, Mo asks Haji about the current condition of the Ummah, which translates roughly to community, but which actually refers to a supranational collective of Islamic peoples. They hope to destroy our Ummah, you record Haji saying in English before he gives a recap of all the bombings, massacres, war crimes, protests, shootings, kidnappings, and assassinations that have occurred in the past 24 hours. Mo listens quietly, only occasionally asking a question or muttering a vengeful prayer. The rest of Haji's children arrive as dinner begins. Lily, the youngest, sneaks into the kitchen and asks her mother which dishes have been prepared without meat. Lily has recently, and secretly, become a vegetarian. 2 weeks earlier, she came home weeping to her mother after having witnessed the vehicular maiming of a duck that was crossing the street with a line of her ducklings. Lily had cradled the duck in her death throes, surrounded by her little ducklings, which, Lily swore, were crying out for their mother. Together, Habibi and Lily wept for the little orphaned ducklings. Later that day, Lily informed her mother that she could not bring herself to eat the chicken korma she had prepared, and Habibi decided not to scold her, a decision she would come to regret. At first, it was only chicken. But then Lily confessed to her mother that she could no longer stomach beef or lamb, the rest of the culinary trinity of Haji's household. Habibi made an effort to explain to her daughter that vegetarianism was a slippery slope toward feminism, Marxism, communism, atheism, hedonism, and eventually cannibalism. Animals are animals, her mother explained deftly, and humans are humans. And when you begin mixing up the two, you will find yourself kissing chickens and eating children. Lily swore that it was a matter not of ethics, but of physical repulsion, and that with time, inshallah, she would be able to eat all her favorite dishes again. Habibi relented, and for a few days the secret remained solely between her mother and daughter until Mary, Haji's elder daughter, turned toward her sister one afternoon in the room they had shared since Lily's infancy and asked her how much weight she had lost. "None," she said too quickly, laughing. "I'm as chunky as ever." But she had lost weight, 2 pounds. "Then why do you look so pale and self-righteous?" Mary asked, continuing her interrogation. Sharp, uncompromising, and with an excellent eye for weakness, a trait that you assume she inherited from her grandmother, Mary has many talents. Deception, introspection, manipulation, a high pain threshold, and embroidering, that are wasted in Haji's household, where the girls are allowed to go only to school or to the mosque and then must come straight home. It's really a tragedy, you think. She could have been a fine spy. In the end, Lily confessed her sin to Mary, who immediately mocked her. "Idiot," she said, "you're short enough as it is. How do you expect to get taller without protein?" "I'll eat beans." "Beans? How many beans? This room isn't ventilated enough for you to be eating beans all day." "Please," Lily said, "don't tell." Mary laughed and promised to snitch as soon as she could, which was a lie, of course, because Mary wasn't the sort. During dinner, Lily is always careful to serve herself a heaping portion of chicken or kebab or kofta, but while she eats rice and fried vegetables, Mary, an avowed carnivore, nonchalantly clears away Lily's meat. Haji, fortunately, never notices. He eats with perfect focus, in total silence, and with his fingers. Habibi, on the other hand, hardly eats. She is all questions and stories. She wants to know about Mo's butchering, Mary's studying, Lily's friends, and even Marvin's gaming. In response, the children tease her, which, at times, upsets Haji, but Habibi always takes it in stride. She is, in your professional estimation, the beating heart of the household. Not only does she take on most of the chores, she also actively organizes the entire social life of the family. Dinners and parties and showers and gatherings and even the occasional communal prayer. Seemingly at war with the 100 silences that fill her small house, she is almost always on the brink of shouting in Pashto or Farsi or English or sometimes Urdu. She chats so much on the phone, outside in the yard, inside in the kitchen, with her gloomy husband, her spiteful mother-in-law, her eclectic children, and her many, many friends, that you end up spending half your time at the office skimming through hours and hours of Habibi's gossip, translated from your audio recordings by an officially sanctioned team of Afghan-American interpreters who are only ever provided with fragments of her statements in the hope that they won't figure out whom exactly they are interpreting. Habibi's relentless chatter, however, is not completely useless. Every night, before bed, she calls her family in Afghanistan, some of whom still live in a small village in Logar province, which, according to your research, is currently under the control of the Taliban. The word comes up sometimes amid Habibi's barrage of Pashto and Farsi, her balays and bachams and chikas and kirs. "Taliban," she will whisper into her phone, as if she knows you are listening. Just the sound of it makes your heart race. After dinner, Marvin and the girls rush off to their rooms while Mo, his parents, and Bibi drink tea in the living room. Inevitably, the conversation turns to Mo's prospects for marriage. Habibi has a niece in Kabul, a midwife, and a beauty who speaks English, Pashto, Farsi, and Urdu. "She is almost too good for you," Habibi says, laughing. Haji has a niece in Logar, only 16, wholesome, holy. She has memorized half the Quran, and her father is a respected mullah in the village. What Mo's parents don't know is that Mo is already in love with a girl at Sac State. They are constantly messaging, conversing, and Snapchatting. Mo writes her secret love poems on his laptop, horrendous verses that he is rightfully embarrassed by. Sometimes, when he thinks he's alone, he recites his poems quietly. His love, you hope, will save him. At night, Haji and his wife are the first to go to bed. The next morning, they will wake up at dawn, Haji because of his pain, and Habibi because of Haji's pain. Both Marvin and Mo pretend to fall asleep. But when Mo thinks Marvin has passed out, he sneaks downstairs with his laptop and, as soon as he does, Marvin climbs out of his own bed, performs wudu, and begins to make up all the prayers he missed throughout the day. Though Marvin has earned a 3.8 GPA in his first semester at UC Davis, though he works part-time and donates money to Afghanistan, his parents often scold him for not praying, not reading the Quran, and Marvin never utters a word in self-defense. And yet here he is, in the middle of the night, praying in secrecy, away from the approving eyes of his mother and father and brother and grandmother, reciting verse after verse from the Quran in a voice so soft and melodic that it almost brings tears to your eyes. Downstairs, Mo descends into forums. Swaddled in his father's woolen shawl, the very same shawl that Haji used to wear in the days of his long-ago jihad, Mo watches clips of American bombs falling on Iraqi cities, Afghans bearing witness to ISAF executions, Muslim boys being burned alive in Gujarat. He watches these clips for hours, his head bobbing, his eyes bleary, until his beloved mercifully notices that he is online and commands him to go to sleep. Upstairs, Mary is reading Mo's messages. She has hacked into his Facebook account and watches his conversation play out in real time. She is a ghost on his profile, always careful to read only what he has already read and to leave everything else untouched. Such potential, you think. Such a pity. Lily, in the bed next to Mary, is sketching pictures of ducks and ducklings and ponds and ducks crying into ponds and ponds expanding into oceans and ducks in flight and ducks walking and ducks dying. And she takes pictures of these charcoal portraits and posts them to a private Instagram account. which Mary can also secretly access. In the room adjacent to the girls, Haji and his wife have a quiet argument about his wife's brothers. You recognize their names and suspect it has something to do with the fact that they were employed as interpreters for the U.S. military in Afghanistan. Haji, you know, considers these men to be traitors. Eventually, Habibi turns away from her husband, mutters something under her breath, and cries herself softly to sleep. Haji does nothing to comfort her. He sits up in bed, wheezing with pain or regret, and stares out the window at the dark street, where Mo is now shadowboxing beneath a streetlight. Tucked away in her corner of the house, Bibi sits up at that same moment, in the same manner, and stares out her window at the same streetlight. She, too, watches Mo strike at invisible enemies. When the family finally sleeps, you listen to them dream. In the course of the next few weeks, you search for clues, signs, evidence of evil intentions. But to no avail, life merely goes on. Haji repairs a window he broke while attempting to repaint his mother's room. Cold floods the house. Bibi moves into the boys' room, and the boys sleep in the living room. No longer able to sneak away from each other, they carry out long conversations before falling asleep. They discuss their family's finances, their suspicion that their father is hiding bills from them. They plan to confront him, but never go through with it. When they sleep, both of the boys snore, Marvin whistling and Mo sort of growling, and the girls, whose bedroom is closest to the living room, complain to each other all night. The timing of the boys' snoring is uncanny. There is a certain rhythm to it. When Mo murmurs, Marvin bursts, and when Marvin quiets, Mo roars. The girls refer to it as the symphony. Eventually, though, the girls fall asleep, and you become the sole listener. Mo notices blood in his stool, but doesn't go to a doctor. Mary earns a 4.3 GPA for the semester, and Haji buys donuts for the whole family. They all sit in the living room, eating donuts and drinking tea, and Bibi jokes that now they won't have to sell Mary for a pair of goats. The whole family laughs as though in a scene in a sitcom. While Habibi's husband is out buying supplies from a hardware store, she receives a call from her parents in Kabul and discovers that her mother is seriously ill. She tells no one and leaves to visit her brothers across town. Soon afterward, Haji returns home to find her missing. He goes from room to room calling her name. For the first time in weeks, Bibi speaks to her son, informing him that his mother-in-law is sick. Tech workers from the Bay Area have moved into the neighborhood. Property taxes are rising, bills stack up. Haji needs help but won't tell his sons because he doesn't want them to take on more work. He borrows money and credit. He buries the bills at night like corpses. Habibi receives another call from her parents. There will be an operation. It's the heart of all things. Habibi tells only Haji, but Bibi, of course, finds out. In a moment of weakness, Lily eats a Slim Jim that she shoplifted from a gas station near her school. At home, she vomits the processed meat for several minutes. Though everyone assures Haji that Lily will be fine, Haji insists on taking her to the emergency room. As long as we have Medi-Cal, why take the risk, he argues. An hour later, Haji and Lily return home from the hospital, and Haji informs his wife that Lily has become a vegetarian. He asks her to keep it a secret. For now, Haji says. She doesn't want anyone else to know. Habibi promises not to tell a soul. One afternoon, while her father sleeps and her mother cooks, Mary shuffles through Haji's mail and discovers past due bills, three or four from the same creditor. She picks a few of the most urgent, electricity and internet, and rushes upstairs. On Poshmark.com, she sells her own lightly used sweaters and jeans and t-shirts, which she has embroidered with characters from popular animes, Sailor Moon and Totoro and Naruto, and in the course of a week, pays her father's bills online. Habibi tells Marvin about his grandmother's upcoming surgery. "Do you think she will forgive me for abandoning her in that city?" she asks him. Marvin pretends to pause his video game, though he is playing online in real time. He sets his controller aside and listens to his mother's fears without responding. He is killed over and over again. The stack of bills lightens, but Haji hardly notices. When her husband is out, Habibi calls Carl in Berkeley. They chat about his stomach, his rent, his studios, his protests, and his prayers until Habibi begs him, once again, to renounce communism and come home. Carl argues that his father, more than anyone else, should be sympathetic to his cause. Habibi begins to weep, and Carl mutters an excuse and hangs up. You wonder which of your colleagues is surveilling Carl. While Haji watches Al Jazeera, video footage of a young Afghan farmer being executed by an Australian soldier plays on the screen, Mary curls up next to him and picks at the flakes of dried skin in his beard, as she did when she was 4 years old. According to Habibi, this was her special ritual before sleep. Now, Mary has a bottle of olive oil in hand, a tiny dollop of which she pours into her palm and runs through her father's beard. The execution is played again. After being mauled by a dog, the farmer, Dad Mohammed, lies on his back in the middle of a field. His knees are drawn up to his chest, and he is clutching red prayer beads. A soldier stands over him with a rifle. "You want me to drop this SOB?" he asks. There is the sound of a shot, and the footage cuts to black. When Mary is gone and the news segment is finished, Haji sits alone in the living room with the TV turned off. He runs his fingers through the moistened strands of his beard and seems surprised by its softness. On the night before Habibi's mother's surgery, one of Habibi's brothers visits for the first time in months. Mary is the only one who doesn't acknowledge him. In their shared room, Lily attempts to persuade her sister to forgive their uncle for his many insults, attacks, jokes, attacks disguised as jokes, and threats. But Mary refuses. "Mom will understand," Mary says, "but you're not so sure." That night, Habibi and her brother sleep on a red tashak in the living room and quietly pray for their sick mother. In the morning, the news is good, and you cannot help sighing with relief. 6 months into your assignment, you began to doubt your purpose. Haji is falling apart. His doctor has advised him to undergo spinal surgery that may leave him paralyzed. In another era, in a different body, perhaps Haji could have been dangerous. But here now, debilitated by pain and trauma, the old man is no threat at all. You should update your superiors. You should advise them to abort the operation. But you won't. Not now. Not when Mary is about to apply to colleges. Not when Mo is planning to propose. Not when Marvin is making new friends on campus. Not when Habibi's parents are applying for a visa to the States. Not when Haji is deciding whether or not he will go through with the surgery. Not when Bibi is losing touch with her brother. Not when Lily is on the brink of an artistic breakthrough. There's too much left to learn. But then, on a cold summer night, when the rest of the family has driven down to an aunt's house in Fremont, Haji heads up to the attic to fix a pipe. You watch him prepare his tools, climb his ladder, and enter his soaking attic, and in a fine mist of leaking water, Haji fidgets with the pipe until he mutters the S word in Pashto. He crawls back through the water, but on his way down, he slips off the highest rung of the ladder and falls onto the hard tile beneath him. Though the fall must have been only 10 feet or so, Haji has landed awkwardly and broken his leg. He lies on the floor, on his back, staring up at the attic from which he fell. You know for a fact that Haji has broken this leg once before during the Soviet occupation when a Kalashnikov round pierced his fibula and forced him off the battlefield for 6 months. during the heaviest period of fighting in Logar, and that this injury probably saved his life, and that his living while his brother died, while his sister died, while his cousins and friends and neighbors all died, has haunted him his whole life. A minute passes. Two. You know that Hachi always forgets his cell phone in the kitchen, and that the kitchen is approximately 20 yards from the spot where he lies on the floor, unmoving, and that he will have no other choice but to drag himself there and call for help. And yet, he doesn't move. You listen for his breath and hear him rasping. Water drips from the trap door to the attic, and Hachi lifts his hands and washes his face and his arms and his hair as if he were performing his ablutions. It's at this point that both you and Hachi notice the small puddle of blood forming under his head. Hachi pleads to God, and you hear him, and you answer. The ambulance arrives shortly afterward. The next day, as soon as he returns home from the hospital, Hachi purchases a phone recorder on Amazon and, when it arrives, has Marvin hook it up to the landline. No one questions him. No one argues. He listens to hours and hours of recordings in his bedroom, alone or with Habibi, and during awkward moments of silence, pauses in conversations. He stops and rewinds and listens again. "Do you hear it?" he whispers to Habibi in Pashtun. "The breathing?" She waits and listens again and nods her head. "You know this is impossible. You know there is no way for them to hear you, and yet when you are listening to a conversation and there is a pause, a silence, you find yourself holding your breath." Hachi becomes relentless. He searches for you on the phone, in the streets, in unmarked white vans, in the faces of policemen, detectives in street clothes, military personnel, and his own neighbors. He searches for you at the hospital, at the bank, on his computer, his son's laptops, in webcams, phone cameras, and on the television. He searches for you in the curtains and in the drawers of the kitchen and in the trees in his backyard, in the electrical sockets, the locks of the door handles, and in the filaments of the light bulbs. And even as his family protests, Hachi searches for you in shattered glass, in broken tile, in the strips of his wallpaper, the splinters of his door, his tattered flesh, his warped nerves, and in his own beating heart, where, through it all, the voice whispering that he is loved is yours. And now, from the books section of the November 1st, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, "Where Have All the Insects Gone?" Scientists who once documented new species of insects are now charting their perilous decline and warning about what it will mean for the rest of us, by Elizabeth Colbert. In the summer of 1942, Ed Wilson, age 13, decided that it was time to get serious about research. He had already determined that he wanted to be an entomologist, a choice made partly out of interest and partly out of injury. As a child, he'd been fascinated with marine life. One day, he jerked too hard on a fish he caught, and one of its needle-like spines lodged in his eye. The lens had to be removed, and following the surgery, to see something clearly, he needed to hold it up near his face. Insects were just about the only animals that submitted to this treatment. That summer, Wilson was living with his parents in Mobile, Alabama, in a run-down house that had been built by his great-grandfather. He resolved to survey every species of ant that lived in an overgrown lot next door. This proved to be quick work, as there were only four species. But one of them turned out to be, as Wilson put it nearly 80 years later, the find of a lifetime, or at least of a boyhood. It was a species that Wilson had never seen before, nor, it seems, had anyone else north of Brazil. That species is now formally known as Solenopsis invicta, and informally as the red imported fire ant. native to South America, this creature has, from a human's perspective, many undesirable characteristics. Its sting produces first a burning sensation, hence the name, and then a smallpox-like pustule. It has a voracious appetite and will consume anything from tree bark to termites to the seeds of crops like wheat and sorghum. Red imported fire ants have been known to kill fledgling birds, young sea turtles, and even, on occasion, baby deer. They construct rigid mounds that damage harvesting equipment. When a colony is disturbed, hundreds, even thousands of ants are dispatched, more or less instantaneously, to attack the intruder. Wilson once stuck his arm into one of these mounds and described the pain as immediate and unbearable. As he observed to his companions, "It was as though I had poured kerosene on my hand and lit it." Red imported fire ants were almost certainly introduced into the United States in cargo unloaded at the port of Mobile. When Wilson conducted his survey of the vacant lot, they had probably been in the city for several years, but hadn't ventured very far. This soon changed. The ants began to spread in a classic bullseye pattern. In 1949, while Wilson was an undergraduate at the University of Alabama, he was hired by the state's Department of Conservation to conduct a study of Solenopsis invicta. Since no one knew much about the species, the teenage enthusiast counted as an expert. Wilson found that the ants had already pushed west into Mississippi and east into Florida. He was, he later recalled, exhilarated by his first professional gig, which gave him the self-confidence to pursue his insect-driven dreams. By 1953, the red imported fire ant had spread as far north as Tennessee and as far west as Texas, and the so-called fire ant wars had begun. In an early skirmish, the state of Mississippi provided farmers with chlordane, an indiscriminate organochlorine pesticide long since banned. It made little difference. Next, the U.S. Department of Agriculture embarked on a campaign to spray heptachlor and dieldrin, two similar insecticides that also are now banned, over millions of acres of farmland. The campaign killed countless wild birds, along with vast numbers of fish, cows, cats, and dogs. The ants kept marching on. The research basis of this plan was minimal, to put it mildly, Walter R. Schinkel, an entomologist at Florida State University, has observed. Undaunted, the USDA launched itself into a new battle, this time claiming that it was going to eliminate the ants entirely using Myrex, yet another since banned of organochlorine. In the late 1960s, more than 14 million acres were sprayed with Myrex, which is a potent endocrine disruptor. The efforts appears to have had the perverse effect of helping Solenopsis invicta spread by exterminating any native ants that might have stood in its way. As the USDA was raining down destruction, Wilson's career was taking off. He received a PhD from Harvard and was offered a position on the university's biology faculty. The job was supposed to be temporary, but by the time he was 29, he had been granted tenure. Wilson thought of himself as a naturalist in the venerable tradition of Joseph Banks, the English botanist who sailed with Captain Cook in 1768. Wilson loved to explore places no entomologist had surveyed before, and once spent 10 months collecting ants from New Caledonia to Sri Lanka. But he was fated to follow a different path. Wilson became a professional biologist just as it was becoming clear that the biosphere was unraveling. Though he resisted the knowledge at first, later he would have become perhaps the most important chronicler of this crisis, the nation's first great post-naturalist. Wilson is now 92 and lives in a retirement community in Lexington, Massachusetts. He's the subject of a new biography, Scientist E.O. Wilson, A Life in Nature, by the journalist Richard Rhodes. Rhodes, who's the author of more than 20 books, including The Making of the Atomic Bomb, interviewed his subject several times before COVID hit and they had to switch to the phone. During one of Rhodes' visits, he ran into an old friend, Victor McElhaney, a journalist who lives in the same retirement community and, as it happened, had written a biography of Wilson's nemesis, James Watson. Small world, Rhodes observes. Wilson's dispute with Watson was an academic turf battle and, at the same time, something more than that. In 1953, Watson and his collaborator Francis Crick discovered the structure of DNA, the famous double helix. 3 years later, Watson joined Harvard's biology department. Though he was only 28 when he arrived, he treated the 24 other members of the department with an offhand contempt. Specimen collecting, he suggested, was for hobbyists. Henceforth, real scientists would study life by examining its molecular structure. The brilliance of Watson's discovery, combined with his sublime self-assurance, intimidated many of his older colleagues. Wilson, who'd been hired at Harvard the same year, has described Watson as the Caligula of biology. When, owing to an offer from Stanford, Wilson received tenure ahead of Watson, the latter stomped through the halls of the biological laboratories declaiming, according to some sources, over and over again the S word and the F word. Eventually, the differences between the traditionalist and the molecularist were judged insurmountable, and in an intellectual version of speciation, Harvard's biology department split in two. Wilson continued to collect ants. He spent a sabbatical conducting fieldwork on Trinidad and Tobago and in Suriname. But he was, by his own description, fiercely ambitious, and he yearned to make a bigger contribution to science, a contribution more like Watson's. One of the obstacles, he decided, was math. He had never even taken an upper-level course in the subject. At the age of 32, he enrolled in calculus and sat awkwardly in the lecture room with some of the same undergraduates he was teaching. Around this time, Wilson began collaborating with a Princeton professor named Robert MacArthur, who possessed all the mathematical skills he lacked. In 1967, the two published The Theory of Island Biogeography. The book was an effort to explain how island ecosystems come into being, a puzzle that had both fascinated Charles Darwin and his rival Alfred Russel Wallace. It combined field observations with a tangle of equations to account for why larger islands harbor more species than smaller ones, and also why distant islands host fewer species than similar-sized islands situated near a mainland. Wilson and MacArthur proposed that the keys to understanding island biogeography are the rate at which new species immigrate to an island, or evolve there, and the rate at which established species wink out. "There's nothing more romantic than biogeography," Wilson once told the author David Quammen. Though Wilson and MacArthur boldly labeled their work on island biogeography the theory, it was still just a theory. Wilson, the field biologist, was eager to test it on the ground. The difficulty lay in finding the right islands. For a rigorous experiment, these would have to be empty. Wilson hit on the idea of using clumps of mangrove north of Key West. The keys were so small, about 40 feet in diameter, that the only breeding animals on them were insects, spiders, and occasionally woodlice. Wilson persuaded the National Park Service to let him fumigate six of them. Then, one of his graduate students, Daniel Simberloff, who's now a professor at the University of Tennessee, spent a year monitoring the defaunated keys. It was painstaking, mud-splattered work, but at least as far as Wilson was concerned, it paid off. Those keys closest to the shore were quickly recolonized. Species diversity rose and then leveled off, just as Wilson and MacArthur's theory had predicted. On the sixth, more distant islet, recolonization took longer and the eventual number of resident species was lower, more confirmation. Though some of the details of the theory of island biogeography have since been discarded, it's still considered a classic. A paper that appeared on the occasion of its 50th anniversary noted that it remains one of the world's most influential texts on ecology and evolution. As many of Wilson's colleagues soon realized, the significance of the theory extended well beyond actual islands. Through logging and mining and generalized sprawl, the world was increasingly being cut up into islands of habitat. The smaller and more isolated these islands, be they patches of forest or tundra or grassland, the fewer species they would ultimately contain. Wilson had moved on to new research questions and initially didn't concern himself much with the implications of his own work. When the first surveys of deforestation in the Amazon appeared, he was, in his words, tipped into active engagement. In an article in Scientific American in 1989, he combined data on deforestation with the predictions of his and MacArthur's theory to estimate that as many as 6,000 species a year were being consigned to oblivion. That, in turn, is on the order of 10,000 times greater than the natural occurring background extinction rate that existed prior to the appearance of human beings, he wrote. The same year that Wilson published his article in Scientific American, a group of insect fanciers installed what are known as malaise traps in several nature reserves in Germany. Malaise traps look like tents that have blown over on their sides, and they're designed to capture virtually anything that flies into them. The group, the Krefeld Entomological Society, was interested in how insects were faring in different types of parks and protected areas. Every summer, from then on, society members set out new traps, usually in different preserves. In 2013, they resampled some of the sites they'd originally sampled back in 1989. The contents of the traps were a fraction of what they'd been the first time around. Over the next three summers, the group members resampled more sites. The results were similar. In 2017, with the help of some outside experts, they published a paper documenting a 75% decline in total flying insect biomass in the areas surveyed. These areas were exactly the sort of habitat fragments that, according to Wilson's theory, were destined to lose species. Nevertheless, the findings were shocking. In 2019, a second group of researchers published a more rigorous and extensive study, and its findings were even more dire. In the course of just the previous decade, grasslands in Germany had, on average, lost a third of their arthropod species and two-thirds of their arthropod biomass. Terrestrial arthropods include spiders and centipedes in addition to insects. In woodlands, the number of arthropod species had dropped by more than a third and biomass by 40%. This is frightening, is how one of the paper's authors, Wolfgang Weisser, a biologist at the Technical University of Munich, put it. In the years since, many more papers have appeared with comparable findings. Significant drops have been found in mayfly populations in the American Midwest, butterfly numbers in the Sierra Nevadas, and caterpillar diversity in northern Costa Rica. While many species appear to be doing just fine, for instance, the spotted lanternfly, an invasive species from Asia, which was first detected in Pennsylvania around 2014 and has since spread to at least 10 other states, including New York, there is, as was noted in the introduction to a recent special issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences devoted to the state of the insect world, quote, ample cause for concern, end quote. Dave Golson, an entomologist at the University of Sussex, is one of the experts the Krefeld group contacted to help make sense of its data. Like Wilson, Golson could be described as a naturalist turned post-naturalist. He decided to study insects because he found them enthralling, and now he studies why they're in trouble. I have watched clouds of birdwing butterflies sipping minerals from the muddy banks of a river in Borneo, and thousands of fireflies flashing their luminous bottoms in synchrony at night in the swamps of Thailand, he writes in Silent Earth, averting the insect apocalypse. I have had enormous fun, but I have been haunted by the knowledge that these creatures are in decline. Golson bemoans the fact that many people consider insects to be pests. He wants readers to appreciate just how amazing they really are and sets off his chapters with profiles of six-legged creatures. Males of many species of earwigs have two penises. If disturbed during mating, they snap off the one they're using and beat a quick escape. Female jewel wasps sting their prey, large cockroaches, to induce a zombie-like trance. Then they chew off the tips of the roach's antenna, use the stumps to guide the stupefied creatures back to the burrows, and lay their eggs inside them. Aging termites of the species Neocapritomys tarracua develop pouches around their abdomens that are filled with copper-rich proteins. If an intruder is gaining the upper hand or leg in a fight, the elderly termites, in effect, blow themselves up to protect the colony, a practice known as suicidal altruism. The proteins react with chemicals stored in their salivary glands to become highly toxic compounds. Insects, of course, are also vital. They are by far the largest class of animals on Earth, with roughly a million named species and probably four times that many awaiting identification. Robert May, an Australian scientist who helped develop the field of theoretical ecology, once noted, "To a first approximation, all species are insects. They support most terrestrial food chains, serve as the planet's chief pollinators, and act as crucial decomposers." Goulson quotes Wilson's observation, "If all mankind were to disappear, the world would regenerate back to the rich state of equilibrium that existed 10,000 years ago. If insects were to vanish, the environment would collapse into chaos." Like insects themselves, the threats to them are numerous and diverse. First, there's habitat loss. Since Wilson's article in Scientific American appeared in 1989, South America has lost at least another 300 million acres of tropical forest, and Southeast Asia has experienced similar losses. In places like the U.S. and Britain, which were deforested generations ago, the hedgerows and weedy patches that once provide refuge for insects are disappearing, owing to ever more intense agricultural practices. From an insect's perspective, Goulson points out, even fertilizer use constitutes a form of habitat destruction. Fertilizer leaching out of fields fosters the growth of certain plants over others, and it's these others that many insects depend on. Climate change, like pollution and introduced species, present further dangers. The Varro destructor mite evolved to live on and consume the body fat of Asian honeybees, which are smaller than their European counterparts. When European honeyberries were imported to East Asia, the mites jumped hosts, and when European bees were taken to new places, the mites hitch a ride. Varroa mites carry diseases like deformed wing virus, and they've had a devastating effect on European honeybees, probably causing the loss of hundreds of thousands of colonies. In the U.S., and in many other countries, European honeybees are treated as tiny livestock. They're carted around to pollinate crops like apples and almonds, and their health is carefully monitored. But what's been the impact of imported parasites and pathogens on other bees, not to mention ants, beetles, crickets, dragonflies, moths, thrips, and wasps? For 99.99% of insect species, we know simply nothing, Goulson laments. Then there are pesticides. Since the fire ant wars, which were prominently featured in Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, a great many have been taken off the market. New ones, however, have replaced them. Goulson is particularly concerned about a class of chemicals known as neonicotinoids. Neonics, as they are often called, are in some respects even more toxic than Myrex and Chlordane. They were first marketed in the 1990s. By 2010, more than 3 million pounds a year were being applied to crops in the U.S. and almost 200,000 pounds to crops in Great Britain. Neonics are water-soluble, which mean they can leak into soils and ponds and potentially be taken up by other plants. There's a good deal of controversy over the dangers they pose to non-target insects, especially bees. In 2018, the European Union found the evidence of harm compelling enough to ban three key neonics from outdoor use. The chemicals continue to be applied in many European countries under emergency authorizations. Meanwhile, in the rest of the world, including the U.S., their use continues apace. Carson may have won a battle, but not the war, Goulson observes. In the last chapter of Silent Earth, Goulson offers dozens of actions we can take to change our relationship with the small creatures that live all around us. Some involve tending one's own garden. For instance, trying to reimagine weeds, such as dandelion, as wildflowers. Others are regional or national in scope. Plant streets and parks with flowering native trees, or introduce pesticide and fertilizer taxes. The list is long enough that nearly everyone who wants to can find some recommendation to follow. But it's heavily tilted toward reducing the use of pesticides, which, as Silent Earth makes clear, is just one of the many hazards insects are facing. Wilson, who's been called the father of biodiversity, has a bigger idea. In Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life, published in 2016, he argues that the only way to preserve the world's insects, and, for that matter, everything else, is to set aside 50% of it in inviolable reserves. He arrived at that figure, he explained, using the principles of island biogeography. On 50% of the globe, he calculates, roughly 85% of the planet's species could be saved. The task of preserving, or in many places restoring, half the world's habitat is, he acknowledges, daunting. The alternative, though, is to grow dandelions while the world burns. The only hope for the species still living is a human effort commensurate with the magnitude of the problem. And now, from the Passing the Buck department of the Talk of the Town section, November 1st, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the 1% versus the 2% in the Hamptons. If the East Hampton Airport shuts down owing to noise complaints, planes and helicopters from Manhattan will land in Montauk. Guess who's unhappy about it? By Parker Henry. East Hampton, being East Hampton, is home to many people who have access to private jets and helicopters. It is also home to many people who do not. A few years ago, the have-not-quite-as-muches decided that the traffic generated by East Hampton Airport was noisy, annoying, and anti-democratic. A protracted political battle began. Novice activists demanded that the airport be closed. Pickets were organized. The 2% versus the 1%, a local politician labeled the fight. Recently, the town board has been seriously considering closing the airport permanently, a blow symbolically, at least, to inequality everywhere. For many residents of Montauk, the increasingly glam fishing town on the eastern tip of Long Island, the possible closure was a source of distress. With East Hampton off limits, jet setters from Manhattan would land at Montauk's little airport. Was the 2% just foisting its noise and traffic problems onto the 3%? A week ago, residents held an emergency town hall discussion at the fire station. We are the ugly stepchild of the Hamptons, Victoria Rudolph, a local property manager, said from the back of the room. Let me tell you, no one gives a rat's patootie about us. A woman in a flowered dress added, it's classic East Hampton. They have a problem that's their own, and they send it right over for us to deal with. But guess what? We don't want their sloppy seconds. Jeffrey Bragman, a councilman from East Hampton, smoothed his tweed jacket and stood up to speak. Muted boos echoed through the room. Montauk is technically a part of the town of East Hampton, but a dozen miles distant. Political power and decision-making lie with East Hampton. Before Bragman opened his mouth, a member of the crowd yelled at him, "You take our money, but you don't care about us!" Many Montaukers spoke against the airport's closure, but there wasn't a clear consensus about what exactly the objection was. Increased noise over Montauk? Ecological devastation? Imminent casualties due to Montauk's short runway? They did seem to agree that fighting the private aviation industry was futile and that Montauk would pay the price. The billionaires aren't going anywhere, Tom Bogdan, the retired founder of a chain of home furnishing stores and the head of Montauk United, which organized the meeting, said, "I hate to break it to everyone, but these guys are going to fly their planes to their houses whether we like it or not." A woman wearing a Prada fanny pack and combat boots had a question. "What's wrong with the train?" One answer, "Nothing's wrong with the train unless you're used to riding in helicopters." Rob Weisenthal, the founder and CEO of Blade, the urban mobility company that flies helicopters from Manhattan to East Hampton, who was wearing a powder blue sweater and chunky framed glasses, told the group, "Our focus at Blade has always been shared aircraft at low cost. A flight out to East Hampton could cost as low as $295. The offer is available in the off-season only, and only with a $965 commuter pass. Normally, a seat costs $795. "Helicopters are not just for wealthy people anymore," he said. The crowd jeered. He added, "Our clients, these people, are not going to stop flying out here, so it's really in everyone's interest to keep the airport open." A man in a tracksuit and wearing an orange Rolex said, "I take a Blade 2 times a week from East Hampton to New York, and if the airport closes, it will be very inconvenient for everyone." He went on, "I tried to land in a plane at the Montauk Airport once, and we almost ran right into a deer. It's a very, very dangerous airport." Bogdan said that some East Hamptonites have downplayed the traffic threat. "They say Montauk Airport doesn't even have a ladies' room," he said, but he wasn't buying the argument. Chuck Morisi, a commercial fisherman who donated 7,000 pounds of fish to the local community last year, picked up a button showing a helicopter with a slash through it. "Helicopters, pah," he said. "The least of our problems. Beach erosion is what we should care about." Rudolph, the property manager, mentioned another traffic nightmare. "Have you seen the trade parade?" she asked, referring to the bumper-to-bumper construction trucks heading to work on Hampton's houses. "Hell," she said, "if I had the money, I'd take a plane too." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.